Lecture S 46, April 29th, 1963, The Dependence of Amplitudes on Time. Lecture S 46, April 29th, 1963, The Dependence of Amplitudes on Time. Lecture S 46, April 29th, 1963, The Dependence of Amplitudes on Time. Lecture S 46, April 29th, 1963, The Dependence of Amplitudes on Time.
The lecture which I, that confused mess which I gave last time as a lecture was supposed to represent something beautiful, but I failed to convey the spirit of the thing. So it's not very important to worry about. I apologize for the difficulties that you may have been going through. It wasn't very good. This is still experimental. I never taught this stuff before. Next time around, I'll do the same thing at a later stage when you can understand better what I'm driving at. Therefore, forgetting about that wasted lecture, we continue in a different direction. I want now to talk a little bit about the behavior of amplitudes in time. I say a little bit because the actual behavior in time involves the behavior in space and time and involves us in the most complicated situations to do it correctly and in detail. But I want to get some, this difficulty always exists with us, that if we can do something logically rigorous but abstract, like the last time, or we can do something logically not at all rigorous but sort of sloppy and give us some idea of something, and then later we can do it more carefully. So with regard to energy dependence, I'm going to make a number of, I'm not being logical, I'm just telling you things that have been found out and to give you some feeling for the behavior of amplitudes as a function of time. As we go along, the precision of the description will increase. So don't get nervous that that this thing seems to be out of the air and so on. It is all, of course, out of the air of experiment. Plus, imagination of people, and it takes a lot of it'll take us too darn long to go over the history of the thing, so we have to plunge in somewhere. And we can either plunge in the abstract and deduce everything, which you don't understand, or go through a large number of experiments, which takes too long, or something in between. So I try another technique. Last time I tried theoretical deduction. Now I try a mixed technique. Okay. Situation is, if that a thing, like an electron, with nothing around it in empty space, has a certain energy. In fact, it's rest energy, if it's standing still. Another thing, like an atom, can have energy too, total mass, mass energy, if it's standing still. But it could also be excited internally to another energy level. The machinery of this we'll describe later. At the end of the energy level that it has some, even at rest, a different energy than it had at the bottom level. And there are a large number of possible energy levels. In the case of an atom in an excited state, it doesn't last forever. And the idea that it's in an energy level is approximate because it's in interaction with the electromagnetic field. And thus it manages to discharge its energy into the electromagnetic field so that a new state is generated with the atom in the lower state and the electromagnetic field excited. The total energy of the system is the same after as before, but the energy of the atom is reduced to a new level. Incidentally, why does it go one way instead of the other way? Why does it radiate light? It has to do, again, with the entropy, that when the energy is in the form of the electromagnetic field, there's so many different ways it can be, so many different places it can wander, that if we look for the equilibrium, we find that most of the time, the equilibrium should have the photon excited and the atom be excited, and it takes an awful long time for it to come back and to find that it can knock the atom back up again. So in an analogous way to the classical theory, why does an atom, or why does an accelerating charge radiate? It isn't that it wants to lose energy, because as a matter of fact, when it radiates, the energy of the world is the same as it was before. It's now in the field. It wants to lose entropy, or rather gain entropy, and make more chaotic. And so it's the same thing in the case of photons. The same thing happens in the case of nuclei. There can be different energy levels, and in an approximation in which we disregard the electromagnetic effects, then we could say to an approximation that when a nucleus is in an excited state, it stays there. Of course, it doesn't stay there forever. Well, a lot of ideas are good approximations. And so the idea, for instance, that an atom is in an excited state and isn't radiating, we forget about the radiation for a while, is a legitimate approximation under certain circumstances. Then we have peculiar particles, which themselves have different masses, but they disintegrate into something else. So these states that I'm talking about of definite energy are not always of precisely definite energy, or rather, they're not perfect. They don't last forever. But we'll suppose they do. We'll forget about certain radiation processes, and if it's not true that we can neglect them, we'll later learn how to calculate them. So we have an object, an atom, something, which at rest would have an energy, which we could call the mass of the whole thing at rest times C squared. This mass includes internal energy, so an excited atom has a different mass than the other. I'll call this energy, energy at rest. Then, if an object, the thing that corresponds in quantum mechanics to an object at rest is this, that the amplitude to find this object anywhere is the same. It is independent of position. It's equally likely to be found anywhere, A. And B, it's got equal amplitude to be found anywhere. That's not exactly the same thing. To say it's equally likely to be found anywhere still permits that the phase vary from point to point. But I say the amplitude's equal everywhere, then it corresponds to being at rest. Now, however, the amplitude to find it varies with time with the following formula, E zero times the time. The amplitude to find it at different places is the same, but it varies in time in that way, and we'll just suppose that that's true. If the atom is in a different state with a different E naught, then the variation with time is different. If you don't know in which state it is, but it has a certain amplitude to be in one state and a certain amplitude to be in the other, then there must be an interference between these two different components with two different frequencies, and then there'll be some phenomenon of other. Something will happen. Because if I ask for probabilities here, you see the absolute magnitude of this squared is constant and nothing's happening. So you notice if a thing is in a has a definite energy, then if you ask any question about it, a probability question, it turns out that the answer is independent of time. Although the amplitudes vary with time, if the energy is definite, they vary sinusoidally, I mean exponentially, so the absolute values don't change. And that's the reason we often say that an atom at a definite energy level is in what we call a stationary state, means that if you make any measurement of the things inside, the probability distributions inside and so on, then you'll find nothing in probability will change in time. In order to have a probabilities change in time, we have to have the interference of two different amplitudes at two different frequencies. And that means that we have to not know what the energy is. That is, it's got some amplitude to be in a state of one energy and another amplitude to be in a state of another energy. And that's the situation when something is behaving as a function of time in a physical sense. It's not in a stationary state. Of course, you could also write this e to the minus I omega t, and then you have h omega equals e naught, so equals m naught c square, and so on. And there's different ways of measuring energy, either by the frequency of amplitudes, by the energy in a classical sense, or by the mass measured by inertia. They're all equivalent. They're just different ways of saying the same thing. If we have two different states with two different energies, then the amplitudes for the two different states as a function of time would vary this way, one this way and one this way. And if we had a certain amount of this plus a certain amount of this together, that'd be an interference. But notice that if I added a constant to both energies, it wouldn't make any difference. If somebody else were to use a different scale of energy, he would use energy plus a constant A, and all his energies would differ from mine by adding 2.1 ergs. Then the amplitudes in the various states would be, in his point, E1 primes and so on, which you see is e to the minus I A over H T times e to the minus I E1 T over H. So that all his amplitude in every respect, not only this one, but also this one, number two, this one and this one would both be multiplied by the same factor. And all combinations and interferences and so on, and linear combinations, would all be multiplied by the same factor. And so when I took absolute squares, the factor would make no difference. And so we can measure energy from anywhere we want. For relativistic purposes, it's nice to measure the energy so that m naught c square is included. But for many purposes that aren't relativity, it's nice sometimes to subtract some standard mass size away from all the energies and to write the energies as some rest mass energies plus W's. For instance, this might be the mass of the atom, the parts of the atom, or the mass of the atom in the ground state, say. And this isn't the energy in the ground state, but differs by such a small amount that we like to discuss the excess, which we call the energy of excitation. So sometimes we may shift the energy by some very large constant, but it doesn't make much difference. It doesn't make any difference if we shift all energies by the same constant in a particular calculation. That's so much for a particle standing still. Now, if I suppose that the relativity theory is right, that if somebody else, for me, a particle is standing still, and if this is my time axis and space axis, nutty, of course, then the amplitudes are constant at all positions, and if I plot them against time, the nodes, there are no nodes, it's a pure exponential, but the place where the real part of the amplitude, say, goes through zero, then the imaginary part is maximum. Yeah, certain lines in this plane at constant time. But for someone who uses different axes in space and time, this is a sloppy description because you have to use funny axes. Lorentz transformations isn't exactly the same as a rotation. But for someone who uses axes relative to which I'm moving, there'll be a different frequency in time, and there'll also be waves in a space direction. And you know that if I make a Lorentz transformation of this thing to new axes, I'll get a form that looks like this, a new E, which I call E sub P, minus P dot X vector, where I made a transformation in the direction P of a certain amount, certain speed, a certain Lorentz transformation, and this is the formula for the amplitude that would turn into if the object is moving in my system. Because in the system in which it's at rest, it's that, and it turns into this. Where EP is given by the square root of P squared C squared plus E naught squared, where E sub P is, to remind you, is the energy calculated when a thing is moving with momentum P. Incidentally, if you make this approximation M plus W, then we would subtract the main part M, and we get WP is equal to W plus p squared over 2m as an excellent approximation, and then non-relativistic approximation. So if you use W's instead of E's by subtracting a constant m from every case, and suppose that all the energies are small and the momentum is not too big, then we get a simple thing. There's an internal energy of excitation which has different values for different levels, plus the so-called kinetic energy of motion of a center of gravity. But we'll work most of the time non-relativistically. So I have most of my calculations with W's. But it's interesting to notice that this is not an extra assumption about the moment. It comes from the relativity. The fact that the particle now, the fact, of course, is that the particle now has a dependence in space of its amplitude. And the amplitude in space varies sinusoidally with a wavelength which can be got from the formula relatively easily, and we've talked about many times. The wave number is P over H, and the wavelength is 2 pi over P over H, or Planck's constant over H is the wavelength. We talked about that before. And the frequency is related in the same way as before to the energy. Incidentally, we have discussed also a situation that if we have not just a wave corresponding to a given momentum, but the superposition of two waves of two different momenta, and by superposing these two waves, we can get beats and pulses and variations in amplitude in space. With this wave alone, the probability of being everywhere is the same, because if you take the absolute square of this, it's constant. Although it looks like if you square a sine wave, you should get bumps from the zeros. Don't forget that it's not a sine wave, it's an exponential, so it's cosine plus I sine, and what the cosine doesn't do, the sine does, so it adds up to constant. This should be some kind of a corkscrew somehow. So it's equally likely to be everywhere. However, in order to get a situation where it's not equally likely to be everywhere, we can consider the case when there are two different momenta and a superposition of two such waves or more. Then we get bumps. And as the various waves move, because they have different velocities of the waves for different momenta, the bumps move around in the wave. And we know, we've already studied what happens if we try to make a wave which has a, which is like what we call a wave packet, which has a slow modulation in space, or slow in space modulation relative to the rapid variations due to the wavelength P. Now, how this thing moves, we've already discussed, and it's called the group velocity of the waves. And I might remind you that the group velocity is a derivative of the wave number with respect to the frequency. Now, the wave number within the Planck's constant, which is merely a factor of scale, is the momentum, and the frequency in the same scale as the energy. And so this is, it should have been the frequency with respect to the wave number. It's therefore the E sub P dP. And then looking up the formula for E sub P, something's the matter with the C's. No. If you differentiate E sub P, I hope that you get P over EP for this, which is the momentum divided by the mass of the object, which is the classical velocity. So what we call the classical velocity of the particle is really the velocity of the group velocity of the waves representing the particle in quantum mechanics. In the special case that you use this approximate formula, this checks very easily if you differentiate instead W, because adding a constant to E doesn't make any difference. And so in the approximate case, we differentiate P squared over 2M and get P over M, which you probably do recognize now, is the classical velocity of a particle. Incidentally, from a point of view of physics, you realize that when I say to add two waves of different frequency, two waves of different wave number together, two waves of different P together, to find out what happens, I have added something that I did not deduce from the theory of relativity. I told you what a wave did when it stood still. I deduced what it would do when it's moving. But I cannot deduce from relativity what would happen if there were two waves moving at different speeds. If I stopped one, I haven't stopped the other, and I cannot make up my mind. So I have added tacitly, sneakily, without saying so, the extra hypothesis that not only is this a possible solution, but that all kinds of P's are allowed in the same system through interference, that you're allowed to have interferences of different values of P. So not only is this a special solution, but all kinds of solutions of this, like this, may interfere. And that's why we get this. This is, of course, very much a reminder of things that we had before. So you see, I've changed gears. I'm going much slower and easier now. Now I would like to discuss what happens inside of a potential. Suppose that we have a box which we have raised to an electrostatic potential, but it's a great big box. It's a can, and then somebody happens to put a voltage on the can, and inside there are a charged object. In such a way that the potential energy, I don't mean the potential, but Q times the potential, or the potential energy of the charge in here is V, Q phi, and is absolutely independent of position. Then there shall be no change in the physics inside. There's no change in the physics, of course, because the constant potential doesn't make any difference as far as anything going on inside is concerned. So first we have to discuss the effects of a constant potential independent of position. And in order to do that, I take a guess. I mean, don't deduce it or anything, because I can't. So I take a guess. And this is the guess, and the right one, of course. I wouldn't bother you with the wrong guess. In a potential, the answer is, if it's a constant potential, that the wave looks like this. It's the EP that you'd calculate from the momentum P plus V times the time is the way things vary, minus P dot X. Now, that's not hard to remember. The general principle is that the coefficient of the time, the frequency, is the total energy of the system. This system has two kinds of energy. It has its mass or kinetic energy, mass and or kinetic energy here. But in addition, it has a potential energy from being in the box, And so we add them two to get the two together to get the total energy, which is the coefficient of the frequency term here. Then it has still a momentum variation with x. Now you say, that's all very well, but the question is whether or not that will affect the physical phenomena inside the box. If there were several different energy levels and so on, different masses, different values of EP. For instance, if I wrote it in a non-relativistic form, I would write this as, I take out the M, all out. Then I have W, internal energy, plus P squared over 2M, plus V, times T, minus P dot X, as the wave. I may have different values of W, and I may have interferences among them and whatnot. The question is, nothing should happen on account of a V, and it doesn't happen, because this is exactly the same as e to the minus IH times V times T, multiplied by what I would have had I had no potential, namely W plus P squared over 2M times T minus P dot X, right? Right. Therefore, all amplitudes of this same object, of the same object. If there were objects of different charges in here, there's another problem, but we'll talk all about the same object, maybe different internal states. All would have the same potential energy, independent of position, and when you made interferences between those states, the probabilities would be not altered. It's like any constant to the energy, and then no phenomena would be altered. So far, so good. Two reasons, therefore, for doing it. One is, it looks like a generalization to add to the energy, this term. And secondly, it doesn't make any effect for a constant potential. But in order to get some feeling that the thing is really right, we have to see whether or no it behaves right in the case when there's a varying potential. Again, we have no right to guess or to say what the answer is for a varying potential. By varying, I mean either varying in time or space. And I am not going to discuss that. It has to be done through a differential equation rather than through describing the solutions, which is what I'm trying to do. So instead of when things vary in space and time, we have to do it in the form of a differential equation, which we don't want to get concerned with now. But I would like to use these ideas as a rough idea to understand more or less how some things happen. So I now consider the case of a retarding potential. Suppose that I have a region here where the potential is nearly constant and a region here. Let me be more precise. I'm trying to make a comparison between the quantum mechanics and the classical mechanics so that you'll get some feeling for the fact that this thing, which is called the energy up in here, which is really the frequency of the amplitude, is in fact related to the energy that you're used to thinking of in the classical physics. I mean, so I have to take examples which are in between. So I imagine a relatively large distances on the, as far as the wavelengths are concerned, over which the potentials are very nearly constant, because in any classical equipment with voltages and grids and so on, the distances over which the potential appreciably varies is enormously long compared to the tiny distances of the waves. The waves are very short. So let's consider a situation in which there's one potential here and another potential here. To be definite, suppose that this is V, a zero, and this is some potential V, which is positive energy in there. Now we know if we shoot a particle through such a slit or whatever it is, that when it gets in here, it should have less energy, less momentum than when it's in here. By the conservation of energy, it has the same energy in here and in here, classically. So it ought to be slowed up by the potential drop through which it fell. Now let's see if we can understand how it got slowed up in going through. I'm going to suppose that if I'm limited to this region, that to an excellent approximation, this is the right formula with the potential appropriate to this region. And then if I'm discussing the waves mainly in this region, that this again is a good approximation to the wave in that region. How it goes in the intermediate region where the V is changing and I have to worry about details, we don't worry about it very much. But we suppose that's roughly speaking as we go along, as long as the potential doesn't change much, this is roughly the way the wave function behaves. But I mean the potential doesn't change much, I mean doesn't change rapidly, much over its wavelength of the wave. Now then, it's easy to see what happens. We have a wave in here, which is given by a formula like this with one momentum, P1, V1, P1. Let's suppose that the internal energy of this object is the same. We say it's an electron, has nothing you can do inside. So it has P1 in the one region with its with V1 times T minus P1 dot X. And then this wave is going to run in through this thing and come out on the other side. And on the other side, it's going to look like this, W plus P2 squared over 2M plus V2 times T minus P2 dot X. Well, that's very interesting. The only problem is a matching problem. If this is the way the thing looks over on this side, how does it look over on here? You say, here, it looks like this. I know, but what's P2? But we're going to suppose that the circumstances in this region, the potentials, are fixed, are constant in time, and that there's nothing varying in time. And we'll then suppose that the oscillations of the amplitude, which vary at a certain frequency, vary at the same frequency everywhere, for there's nothing depending on time in the medium, or so to speak, through which the waves go, if you would like to say it that way. Then we can suppose that the frequency in here and the frequency in here is the same, analogous to the way light going through a material, where the materials aren't moving, never changed its color. So if we simply suppose then that the waves go through a region in which the frequencies do not change, that nothing is changing, so that the wave which is in one region will generate all over the space subsidiary waves all at the same frequency, then we know that the frequency in the one place and in the other are equal. This is just the conservation of energy. In fact, it's even true if the thing is complicated, and if it goes through, well, all right, let's leave it this way. I was going to say it's true if for some reason this thing is lost as de-excited, but you have to be very careful about the reason, because you've got to worry about the apparatus which de-excited, whether it took energy away. So never mind, excuse me. Anyway, this equals this, and this is just the conservation of energy, this energy that we would calculate classically in one region and in the other region. The conservation of energy is simply the fact that, in this case, that the frequencies don't alter because the conditions aren't changing with time, and frequency is energy. And of course, you realize then that the momentum P2 that's obtained from this equation, in the particular case that V1 is 0 and V2 is positive, is less than the momentum P1, and the waves are longer, and the velocity of the group, which is the classical velocity, which is P over M, approximately, is less, as required in exactly the same way. From here on, the calculation is the same as classical, from here on, because this is a classical equation. Incidentally, there's one very interesting case. Suppose that the V here is bigger than P1 squared over 2M, so that when we calculate the P2 out of the other end of it, we get negative for P2 squared. That means that P2 is negative, imaginary. And that does have a thing that doesn't correspond classically. If we have a region where the potential is so high that the classical momentum that you would calculate is squared, is less than zero, you'd have to have negative kinetic energy to be in there, then classically there's no probability of being in here anywhere at all. But quantum mechanically it turns out that the solution is still the same. It's e to the I P2x over h as far as space is concerned. But P2 is now imaginary, I times something. And so it goes as e to the plus or minus some constant times x, which is exponentially decay or rising. Now, the two different cases correspond to two different physical circumstances. So first, let's study the decay. This means that the amplitude in here is, if there was waves, a real object coming here trying to get in, it does go in with some amplitude. It sticks in a little bit with a decaying amplitude, but any reasonable distance away from the walls or the edges where the potential has suddenly changed, there's no amplitude at all. It's like the critical angle for light in glass. There's no light on the back when you're above the critical angle if you're more than a few wavelengths in the far away. But if you come too close, then there is some amplitude to go through. Incidentally, the arising exponential is for the case that somebody's feeding stuff from a similar bump from the other side. Now, this phenomenon is quite striking and interesting, and the analog, in the case of light, of the fact that if you have two sheets of glass with light above the critical angle, there's a little bit of leakage through, has a correspondence in quantum mechanics. And then if you have a very narrow region where the potential V is so great that the kinetic energy to be in this region will be negative, So that classically the darn thing could never get out because the could never get through because the retarding potential is too high during this region. If in this, here's a potential zero, here's a very high resisting opposing potential, here's zero again, so high enough that it would, that there's not enough energy to get through. Nevertheless, quantum mechanically, there is this little decaying amplitude and there's a weak wave which works its way through, and there's a certain probability then to appear on the other side, which is called penetration of a barrier. This is explains or is the description of the fact that alpha particles can come out of a uranium nucleus, even though if you calculated the electrostatic repulsion that such particles would have to climb to put them back in, they haven't got enough energy to get to the center, to the nucleus. If you try to shoot the corresponding alpha particle back and calculate classically, it hasn't got enough energy to get in. But how did it ever get out then with this low energy? See, if you write, draw the picture of the potential energy as a function of radius for a uranium nucleus, then you find a very high value here. But of course, it's very strongly attracted when it gets in. Now, the alpha particles that are found have this energy. That is, if they're shot back, they can only get to this radius and then go out. They never could be here. Classically, you'd think if an alpha particle would get out, it would at least start at the top of this thing and go and have at least this much energy. But it hasn't. It has very much less energy. And the way it gets out is that it leaks with this exponential decay through this region. It takes several billion years. It takes 4.5 billion years on the average for your atom or your alpha particle to work its way out of the uranium nucleus. It's rather remarkable that a number like 4.5 billion years can come out of a set of numbers of something so rapid as the oscillations of the particle in the nucleus. Where's the orders of magnitude which determines 4.5 billion years from the rapid motions on the inside? And the answer is it's e to the minus da 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 da. So 4.5 billion years is e to the minus a big number, which is the thickness of this barrier divided. Well, you could figure it out. It's the question of how much the how imaginary the momentum is over how big a distance. And when you put that in, you find a tremendously small factor, which accounts for the fact that the amplitude to find the alpha particle outside the nucleus is very small relative to the amplitude to find it inside. So if you have a lot of atoms to test, you'll find that most of them haven't disintegrated in a very, very large fraction. One more example of the potential, I would like to show a little more detail how we've already explained how the potential retards something. I would like now to finish the analysis to show that this picture of potentials is all right by showing indeed that a particle will be deflected by a potential gradient in the same way as a force will I erased the key formula. That a force will displace a particle, deflect the particle. Suppose that I have a particle that's on a large classical scale, is moving along, and there's a region where there's a potential, and to take an interesting case, because we've already taken the case of potential along the direction of motion, we take a potential which varies, a potential varying this way, we take a potential varying at right angles to the motion. So the potential here is a little bit higher than it is here on a very large scale compared to the waves. Very smoothly varying, but varying. Now the point is that if the particle goes through a certain region of this potential, it gets deflected to a new direction. And according to the classical mechanics, I would like to get an idea of the amount of deflection that's produced in going through a region of width W in a potential gradient. It depends only on the potential gradient. As you know, the force is supposed to be equal to the potential gradient divided by the mass. So here's the potential gradient, dv dy, if y is made this way. Divided by the mass of the particle is the force. And if you multiply that by the time, which will be the distance that has to go over the classical velocity, this will give you the momentum that the particle, no, the velocity. Force times time is momentum. Yeah, momentum. Is that right? Yes. Okay, so this is the momentum, sideways momentum that the thing has. Now suppose that the onward momentum that it had, the direct x direction momentum it has, is called p. Then the sideways momentum, supposing small, here would correspond to an angular deflection. I'm going through the distance W. Angular deflection is equal to the sideways momentum over P is equal to 1 over M P dV dy times W over V classical. And it's still left for me to show that my idea, or the idea described there, that the waves go as e to the W plus P squared over 2M plus V and so on, gives the same deflection under this corresponding circumstances. So we have to now analyze the same thing. Classic quantum mechanically, see, we get the same answer. So in this case, though, the question is, why is it deflect in the first place? The answer is that as a particle is going along as a wave fronts here, it's going in the x direction, and as it goes through, since the potential here is not the same as the potential there, the phase is being changed, relative, one to the other. Another way of saying is the momentum turns out to be different, or the phase is changed because of the difference in potential. And so after a little bit, the phases of the two waves, they're not in phase when they're exactly opposite. One got ahead of the other. And the new waves are at an angle. So if delta theta is the angle, and if d is the distance between two parallel tracks, for analysis purposes, then the excess phase here, the excess phase is equal to delta theta times d. The excess distance is a delta theta times d, and the excess phase is that divided by the wavelength times 2 pi, or the wavelength over 2 pi. And incidentally, the wavelength of these waves is given by that formula, momentum over Planck's constant. So we have that this rule at delta theta. Well, that's the formula for delta phase. And we now have to figure out how much the phase actually shifts. You see, if we could get the phase shift from the quantum mechanics, we could find out the delta theta and see if it agrees with this formula. So to figure out how much the phase shifts, we consider that as it goes through here, the potential here during the distance W is different up above than it is below. Let's call the difference in the potential delta V. There's a difference in potential here and here. And if the frequency is constant all over, then the different potentials will produce a different energy. That is, a different kinetic energy or a different momentum. And if you say this is related to this, you find that the change in the V is related to the change in momentum in this way. In this case, let's take the non-relativistic case to understand it easier. You can go home and do it with the relativistic case. If we change V a little bit, then the momentum in the two places is not the same, because these two are the same, but this must be the same within a sign as the P squared over M, which is equal to P over M dP. So the momentum is slightly different in the two places when the potential is slightly different. And then the momentum being different means the wavelength is slightly different and the phase is slightly different. So we have to now figure out the phase from the quantum mechanics this way. That the phase difference will be this. If the wavelength, the momentum is a little different, so the wavelength is a little different. The wavelength or the wave number, the number of waves per centimeter is the momentum over Planck's constant. So this is the change in the number of waves per centimeter, and this is the number of centimeters. So the shift in phase is equal to this. If you wish, you can use this formula which we just obtained for the relation of delta V and delta P to put it in terms of delta V. It turns out to be delta V over H times M over P times W. And incidentally, you could write this right down in the beginning if you wanted to, because this M over P, this is just the velocity of the classical particle. You see, of the group of the waves, and you can see that's true in general. It's W over the group velocity of the waves, which is the same as the classical particle velocity. And this W over the group velocity of the waves is simply the time it takes the waves to go through. And the easiest way to remember this idea is that the phases are changing when there's a potential at a certain rate per second. See, VT always, VT over H is the way the waves go. So here's the difference in potential. Here's the time it's been acting. Over H is a shift in phase. So it's the same thing. And so now, putting these two things quickly together, if I take the, we can obtain the formula for delta theta. It's H over dP times the change in the phase. And the change in the phase is equal to the shift in the potential over Planck's constant times W over the classical velocity. And then the H's go out, showing there's some hope to compare it to classical physical formula. And it didn't work. I got one M wrong. Well, we'll find the M in a minute. Here's a delta V. Let's see if delta V over D, delta V over D is dV dy, all right. Delta dV dy is delta V over D. And then I have 1 over P and W over V classical. Now I look at my notes and find out which of the two formulas is right. There's no M, it says here. Thank you. The force is dV dx, and so the sideways momentum is the force times the time. It's the F equals ma that I don't know. It's the laws that E equals, that the wave numbers and the frequencies I know, but the F equals ma I don't know. At any rate, therefore, we have deduced F equals ma in the sense that if we assume that the phases vary with time, that the potential gives the rate of change of the phase with time, well, precisely. Potential energy at any point gives the rate of change of the phase with time when multiplied by I over H. That statement then is equivalent to the F equals ma, provided that F comes from a potential. And that is what I wanted to illustrate. I would like to also point out an interesting thing that has to do with, well, let's make applications of this. It was not necessary that this V be really electrical potential. It doesn't make any difference what it is that changes the energy from point to point in space, as long as it's slow and smooth, which I will call in the classical limit. But if the energy varies from place to place in the classical limit, then there will be deflections of exactly the same kind that depend upon the rate of change of the energy of the object with vertical position. So the Stern-Gerlach equipment, for example, which shows in quantum mechanics a beam going up and a beam going down, since the thing is quantum mechanical, means that the object which is in this region here has some kind of a state in which it can get, for which its energy varies with how close it is to the upper magnet. And by measuring the degree of the deflection, we can find out how that energy varies. In other words, we can use the classical formulas in a quantum mechanical apparatus, even if it's one beam, and even if the machinery of the classical mechanics is wrong. Because what we determine by this, that the thing is bending up, is that the waves are diffracting upwards. And the fact that the waves are diffracting upwards means that there's a contribution. This time it's from the W, varying from point to point, not the V, if you wish. Depends on how you like to define it, because you're only adding them, so you can put them together or leave them apart. But because something in the internal state or the external conditions or something is varying from point to point, an energy which varies from point to point, then we would get a deflected beam. The fact that we get a deflected beam means that the energy is varying from point to point. And so the fact that there are two beams tells us, since the beams are really quantum mechanical, that in a beam like this, the phase changes. That the wave, if it sits, for instance, in a magnetic field, I mean, the deflection is understandable if you suppose that if it sits in a magnetic field, there's an extra frequency of which is proportional to the magnetic field, in which we write as mu b. That defines mu. Turns out that there's an energy proportional to a magnetic field, and that means that the phase varies this way. Actually, the energy is minus mu b in this upper beam, which is attracted to the what we call upspin. It's just a definition of which way is which. So we call the upspin one, the one which is a negative energy because it's lined parallel the way it likes to go. And the other one would be this. In short, I deduce from the experiment that if I were to take this object and look and leave it in the magnetic field B for a certain period of time, capital T, that the phase of the thing would be changed by this stuff, by E to the plus I over H mu B, capital T. And that the other one, if I took the other beam and put it in a magnetic field in the Z direction for a period of time, capital T, then its phase would be changed by E to the minus I over H mu B times capital T. Changed relative to what it would do if there were no field. And that if I make that assumption that these objects have this property, then I can deduce the deflection by the precise argument that was made over here and see that it agrees with the amount of deflection and thus measure mu, for instance, from the amount of deflection as an example. So we know from the machinery of the original separation, a thing we hadn't looked at before, of the Stern-Gerlach experiment, that the upper beam has a property that if we put it in a magnetic field B, its frequency, its phase changes at a given frequency, and the other changes at the same frequency but with the other phase, opposite sign, I mean, excuse me, the same frequency but opposite sign. This permits us to answer a number of amusing questions. For instance, we can do the following. We can separate a beam and then we can put it in a magnetic field, B, for a certain period of time, capital T. And then we can ask ourselves what it looks like afterward. I give an example and show how to solve it. A typical example. It turns out, and this is a practical one, that the mu mesons which disintegrate from a pion are polarized and have their spins. I don't remember whether it's along or opposite, and it'll take me a couple of seconds to think it out. Well, let's see. Things go to the right. Neutrinos go to the left. Ah, the hell with it. It's one way or the other. They have, let's say, in the direction of the motion of the particle from the the pion was at rest and it disintegrated into a mu. And now this polarization is maintained. We suppose we stop the particle, but it's spinning this way, which we call the x direction. We also know that when a mu disintegrates, the probability of emitting an electron in the x direction is different than the probability of emitting it in the negative x direction. It's more likely to emit it, in fact, in the negative x direction, at least the more energetic electron. The problem is to determine how many, what is going to happen if I put this now in a magnetic field in the z direction. Never minding the details, the problem that we have is to determine if we put it in the magnetic field in the z direction for a length of time t, what is the probability, suppose we would like to know, what is the probability it still appears to be in the plus x direction? Let's say that's the question. The thing is in the x direction. It is then placed in a magnetic field in the z direction for a period of time t. What is the probability at the end of that time that it's in the x direction? There's a typical problem. I show you how to solve it. I will use a representation in which up and down in the z direction are my base states. So the base states are plus z minus z. The actual state at the beginning of the thing, at this time, let's say psi is represent the state, and psi O will represent the state before I turned on the magnetic field, while psi T will represent the state after the length of time in the magnetic field. Now, here's the situation. I know plus z psi 0, which is the amplitude to be in the plus z state before I turn on the field, and minus z psi 0. I know those. How do I know those? Because somebody told me what the state was. They said it was in the state plus x. Being in the state plus x means, when you say it's in the state plus x, that means that the amplitude to be in the z state is this. And so we need a table of these things, which we unfortunately worked out last time. At any rate, it turns out that to be in the, if you're in the x state, the amplitude you're in plus z and then minus z is the same. So supposing that we know these two numbers, that the amplitude to be in plus z is 1 over the square root of 2, and the amplitude to be in minus z is 1 over the square root of 2, then these two are the number, the amplitudes to be in the plus x and a plus z and minus z state initially. They are not, they happen to be equal. Now you might call this c naught, the amplitude to be in the plus z, c plus naught, the amplitude to be in the plus state Minus A, it's just another notation for the same thing if you don't like these horrible things. Now the question is, what happens as a function of time? If it was in the Z state, in the plus Z state, then we know what happens. You see, if a particle is in the plus Z state, then its amplitude to B at the end of the period of time, T, in the plus Z state, is e to the minus I h mu b plus t times what it was before. And the amplitude to be in the minus state is e to the minus I mu h mu b t times what it was before. Now these two laws, this rule is what I was arguing about and explaining and deducing previously. If you don't understand it, we'll just take it as one of the laws of physics, that this is the behavior of a spin one-half object in a magnetic field. But it's demonstrated directly by the deflections in the Stern-Gerlach experiment, that any amplitude to be after a period of time in a plus state is the same as the amplitude you were in the plus state before. It doesn't turn over. It has nothing to do with what amplitude you were in the minus state, and likewise for the negative state. So now our problem is solved. What? Our problem is solved because we can find C plus later, which incidentally is just a fancy notation for the amplitude. To tell you precisely what I mean, it's the amplitude to be in the positive Z state at the time T, right? That's just another writing for the same thing. And that we have is 1 over the square root of 2 times e to the I over h mu b t. Likewise, C minus of t is minus z psi t. The amplitude to be in the other one is the C minus. This is an identity. This part's an identity. And this equality is from this law here. Is minus IH times mu BT. Voila. Now that's fine. We know all about the state then, because if we give the amplitude to be in the two components, we got everything. But the question that was asked was unfortunately not whether it's in the plus Z or minus Z direction. The question is, with what amplitude is it at the time T in the state X? That's what we would like to know. We want to know with what amplitude it's in plus X. But the general formula for any such a thing, you know this thing, it goes like this. We can represent it any way we want, and we've got all the information. If we throw it back, we got all these things for the Z. So we just write this way. It's plus X plus Z times plus Z psi T plus plus X minus Z times minus Z psi T. That's the general way it works. We just simply say this way. The amplitude to be in the positive X direction is the amplitude that it's in the positive Z times, if it's in the Z, that it's in the X, plus the amplitude. There's the two different roots. Plus the amplitude is in negative z, and then it goes from z to x. Then, we need only to substitute all the junk that we found so far to finish the analysis, because all the stuff here is numbers. So under this, I write its number, which is 1 over the square root of 2, because I know that from the tables. This thing here, I worked out just now. You'll read it on the line above. It's 1 over the square root of 2. E to the I over H. It's a pain in the neck to write all those things, but it's true. To write all the exponentials. Now, plus X minus Z is also 1 over the square root of 2, and minus Z psi T is 1 over the square root of 2 times E to the minus I over H mu BT. Voila, we're done. Now, we add those two together. 1 over the square root of 2 times 1 over the square root of 2 is a half, and adding an exponential and its negative exponential together divided by 2 is the cosine. So the amplitude to be in the state in question, the positive x state at the time t, is this. What is it? Does it check if time is 0? The probability should be amplitude should be 1. Yeah, because nothing happened. That's right. It starts in x and ends in x. But as time varies, the amplitude goes up and down like a cosine. The probability to be in the state is the cosine squared of mu b over ht. And the probability to be in the positive x condition, probability to be in positive x as a function of the interval of time used in the experiment, is this. It's 100% if you don't use any interval. And it comes down, it goes up, and it comes down, and it goes up, with an oscillation at a certain frequency. Note that this cycle, to get to the next maximum, corresponds to pi for the angle, not 2 pi, for cosine squared is involved. And so the frequency of the oscillations is mu b, is 2 mu b over h. The frequency is twice as great for these oscillations as you would think by looking at this. It looks like the amplitude only varies at frequency mu b over h, but the amplitude doesn't count if it's only the square that counts. If the amplitude changes sign, it's the same state. You can also, at the same time, understand this better if you'll ask more questions, like what is the probability it's at some other direction? And you'll find, for example, that when it's not in the positive x, it's in the negative x, of course. If you ask for the probability of being in negative x, it's the sine square. If you ask for the probability of being in y, it's 90 degrees later in cycle. In fact, what's happening is that the succession of states corresponds to be polarized in the plus in a succession of directions, which is turning around in space. And we say that by saying that it's precessing at this frequency. All we've checked here is that if it does precess at this frequency, it checks that, because the probability of it in the plus direction is falling off to zero when it's in the negative x, and then rising back again as it goes around. We haven't checked that it goes around without looking, say, at the y direction or some intermediate direction, but if you will look, you will find that it goes around. This, then, is a description of how things behave in a definite example and it's a function of time. That ought to put him back on the track. Huh? Pretty good. That was okay, wasn't it? I mean,
It seems to me you don't need to make near so much apology in the beginning for the maybe abstraction. Maybe you're
right. For the lack of abstraction.
Related to classical.
For the lack of abstraction.
When you say Newton's law, F equals ma, neglecting friction and so on and so on. I mean,
here it's an old-fashioned. I'm still used to it. I can't help it. Yeah. Well, it's not an apology. It's to make sure they understand that.
I mean, maybe relating it to say, well, it isn't so different than just saying that we neglect friction when we say we make an object with no force. It's turning off the electromagnetic field that transitions. It's not so different than neglecting friction.
Yeah, right. I should have said that. I couldn't think of it that way, but that's a good way to say it.
Look, Clement, confused, I think.
Yes, indeed.
You use this terminology here.
Yeah.
I guess this means that the thing, that this is the amplitude that it sort of rotates from the plus x direction, its original polarization to the
no.
What does it mean?
This means the amplitude that if it's in plus x,
it starts out in plus x.
Yes, and if it's, that's the object that's in plus x is an amplitude, is in plus z. In other words, if you made a Sturm Dielock separator, which was organized along the z direction, but the object was originally prepared by one which set it in the x direction, then this is the amplitude it would go through the plus z section of this new Sturm Dielock experiment.
Wait a minute. The Sturm Dielock thing just talks about which way the beat feels when you talk about the orientation of the Sturm Dielock experiment.
Almost, yes. The B gradient, yes.
The B gradient. Then this plus z means really that the B gradient is in the plus z direction.
That's right.
And the plus x means that the spin polarization of the Riemann meson is in the plus x direction.
That's right.
Okay, so now, see if I can get this straight. Then, this means that the mu meson comes in polarizing the plus x direction.
Right.
And
now, any state at all, you can pick any axis you want, let's say the z direction.
Yeah.
Now, any state at all can be analyzed, if you wish, by giving an amplitude that it's at the plus z beam or the minus z beam. The object has got spin ahead. I forgot to say it was spin ahead. It's a mu meson. I forgot to say it's spin ahead. The object has spin ahead, and if I analyze it in the Sturm Dielock experiment, it ends up in one of two beams or both, which can be put back together again if you want.
Yeah.
When it's split open, though, there's some amplitude to be in one beam and some amplitude to be in the other. Not probability, because I have to put it back together again to get my plus x out again. So these are the amplitudes that it's in plus z and in plus x. I mean, it is in plus z and minus z. First case in which it was in plus x. See, each different case it could start in has different amplitudes to be in those two beams. If I make a Sturm Dielock apparatus, which is z-analyzing, all right? And I start with an object that's in the x direction, or any other direction, whatever. It is separable into two beams. I can put them back together again so that the apparatus was only for thinking purposes, because out here it comes in the same condition as it went in, all right?
It separates them in the z-direction.
Well, that is irrelevant, as a matter of fact. However, it separates them according to a field whose gradient is in the z-direction, yes. And it's, so it's analyzing in a certain specific way. I could analyze in other ways, but this is a specific way. Now, I forgot to write a summary today. By sheer error. I just simply slipped my mind. Now, it separates into two beam. And in order to figure out the future behavior and so on, I can give an amplitude that it's up here and an amplitude that's down here. And those are those. And no matter what state it comes in, I can give an amplitude. See, if it comes in any state at all, phi, I give these two numbers. And with these two complex numbers, I can predict everything from then on. I must allow them to interfere back again, of course. I didn't do anything yet. Now, what happens in this other experiment is I happen to put a magnetic field in the z direction. And what's nice, what I know that's nice, is I know exactly what happens to two special cases in the z direction. What happens to the amplitude if it's in plus z? What happens if it's in minus z? That's nice. That's why I have to go to the z-axis. I don't know what happens to plus x until I did this calculation. I know what happened in plus z and minus z, but I can choose any way I want. You see, I choose plus z and minus z. I know exactly what happens there. But then I have to refer everything. I have to say, well, the plus x, let's put it this way. Suppose that I'd separated this, and then I put the z component magnetic field on for a while, and then brought it back together again. It's the same thing, whether I put it on here or I put it on without all this equipment. But if you put it on with the equipment, the reason you can, well, you know, not, is it goes into here, and then it gets shifted by a phase, which we discussed, and this one gets shifted by an opposite phase, either the mu b over times t, and then I try to put them back together again. I add them back together again. That's what I did here. But I don't know, I'm saying the same thing too many ways. This is the amplitude that an object which is in the, known to be in a definite state plus x, will appear to be in the plus z beam, in a, or can be thought of as being a plus z object.
I see. That's what I misunderstood.
Yeah.
Plus z stood for plus z. Also, there's one other
thing. We can just say up in the z direction, whatever that means. And this object that's up in the x direction can be thought of as being up in a z direction. It's the amplitude that's down in the z direction. And then if you know what happens in these two things, then you can see what happens next and work it. You use that as a base, as we did in this calculation. It's a good example of how to use the base and how to use the formula and so on. So study it pretty carefully because it's an important point. Yeah, that's an important point.
And there's one other question I wanted to bother you with.
Yeah.
I remember reading in several places that in quantum mechanics you have to have the, you always have to talk about complex variables and complex functions. And that this is the only way you can talk about it. You can't talk
right.
about it. Real variables.
Right.
Why is that? Why must it be a complex variable?
I don't know, but of course you could always make the real and the imaginary parts of any complex function and call those real variables. So that's a little bit of a thing. It just means that it's much more simple to describe when you have complex, or use complex numbers, e to the I omega t and so on. In particular, I would say that I would like to remind you that your textbook Resnick and Holliday is wrong, definitely, absolutely, and completely wrong in its section on the quantum mechanics, because it represents the thing as a cosine omega t and not by e to the I omega t, so that the probabilities, which is the square, goes as cosine squared omega t,
yeah.
which means that at a certain moment there's no chance of finding a particle, then there is a chance, and so on. That's not the way it behaves. It should be complex, but since he hasn't taught complex e to the I omega t's at the beginning, he couldn't do that, so he cheated and made it to be a real part, but it's wrong, because the square is, oscillates with time, and it doesn't mean anything. So it's just wrong. It cannot be done that way, because conservation of the probabilities won't work.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. I just wondered if you
would comment. Any deeper reason why it has to be complex numbers, nobody knows. I mean, well, there is, but I mean, There's no known, whatever the hell it is. It's deep because it's complex numbers. I mean, most of our trouble is because it's complex numbers. Really, we're not used to them. It's strange. Yes, it's strange, but there's no, we don't know any way to say anything other than that it's strange and true.
I remember saying that if you treat most problems that don't involve magnetic field, you can usually infer they came to a real direction. But once you get into magnetic field, particles, charged particles go into magnetic field or something, you must use complex.
Well, I know what you're talking about, but that's a little bit wrong too. You're talking about calculating energy levels. And when there's no magnetic field, the Schrödinger eigenfunctions, wave functions, are all real. But if you're worrying about anything that depends on time, even if there's no magnetic field, if you ask a question, like the one we asked here about what happens, only this is spin, so you may not believe it when I tell you, but if you ask any other question about what happens to something as a function of time, then you have to put together these two different eigenfunctions, look for interferences as a function of time, like that. And then you see you have to use the complex numbers. But if you're just talking about energy levels, there's lots of chemical work is involved only in knowing the energies, then you can use all real wave functions, with the exception of the case when there's a magnetic field present. Then you need complexes again, because you really should have had complex in the first place. It's just that you're asking a limited number of questions, you see, either without magnetic fields or without time-worrying interferences, either of those two cases, it happens that you don't. How can you explain that certain cases don't involve the, you see? Mm-hmm. It's deeply involved, and in certain special cases, it happens to be possible to forget that. But it's not worth forgetting, because immediately you get into trouble. There's nothing special about the case.
They're related to us by the Lamour theorem, so when your magnetic field is like a change.
I just wondered if I could ask a brief question.
That's
about
true.
Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
Like in this is Saturday's New York Times, says the AEC has not done anything to restore Dr. Oppenheimer's good name, for that was never lost. It has at long last done something to restore its own. And I just wondered for what your brief comment.
That's an excellent remark. Yeah, I think that's very nicely said.
What is this film going to be about?
I mean, it's an experimental demonstration of the change in relativistic life change.
Oh,
accelerator
is not there.
No, not so.